majority of residents feel like they're being disrespected. Because especially if you are an adult in Flint, you are not automatically part of this settlement. You're not automatically going to get anything out of this. You at the very least need to own property. That'll get you something, but it's not going to get you more than $1,000. Beyond that, you have to prove that you've been harmed by the water. And that's something that almost nobody can do. I mean, you have to have like a doctor's note, not only saying you are suffering this health symptom, but it's because of the water. I mean, you could probably guess what percentage of Flint residents have notes like that.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Tainted Tap podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Catronelle Davis, sociologist and author of the book, Tainted Tap, Flint's Journey from Crisis to Recovery. In today's episode, you'll hear a conversation that I had with Dr. Ben Pauly, who is a Flint resident and an assistant professor of social science at Kettering University. During our conversation, Ben spoke a lot about the roots and the consequences of the emergency manager law and the harm that policies like this can cause folk. Ben also talked about the role of transparency, accountability, and teamwork in efforts to address community neglect head-on, and much more. Enjoy the show. On this episode of the Tainted Tap podcast, I've got political scientist, Flint resident, Benjamin Pauly. Dr. Benjamin Pauly is in the house. Dr. Pauly is the author of the book, Flint Fights Back: Environmental Justice and Democracy and the Flint Water Crisis. Welcome, Dr. Pauly.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you on the show. I'm wondering, do you want me to call you Dr. Pauly, Professor Pauly, Brother Ben?
Ben is just fine. That's what I tell my students and everybody else for that matter. So I'm totally comfortable with that.
Cool. Now, I have to, you know, throw a question at you that I throw at everyone else. And it's really about, you know, what has led you to what you're doing right now? We all have our different talents, and but I think it's instructive for folks to know how you got to where you are today. And so I'm wondering, why political science and community studies? Could you talk about the path and the passion that led to the work that you currently do?
Well, yeah, I mean, if we want to go kind of all the way back, when I was a teenager, I started developing a bit of a social consciousness, and it really came out of my time at community college. And there was a particular sociology professor there who really inspired me to start thinking about social issues, but not just in an academic way, also in terms of my own kind of personal position and responsibility with respect to those issues. And so I started getting interested in activism and participating in some activism locally at the time. And my attitude was really to not to go out into the world with any particular political agenda, but rather to just kind of have a look around my own community and get a sense of what was already going on and try to figure out where I could fit in. And so, you know, that was a kind of sensibility that I formed, you know, during my late teenage years, I would say, that I carried forward with me and into other phases of life. But as a graduate student, I really became very disconnected from activism just because I was so busy, you know, with my studies.
I know it, life.
And so when I went onto the job market and, you know, I saw a job posting for an assistant professorship in Flint, Michigan, of all places, at first I kind of chuckled to myself because I never really, I knew about Flint. You know, I watched Roger and Me in that community college sociology course with that professor I mentioned, and it had a huge impact on me at the time, but never had I really ever imagined living in Flint and being part of that community. But long story short, eventually I decided to accept the job, and I moved here with my family, and I was determined from the beginning to be involved with the life of the community in one way or another. And again, my attitude was just to kind of have a look around and see what was going on and try to figure out where I could fit in. And so, when we arrived in the summer of 2015, there was not yet an official Flint water crisis. There had been, you know, already a year's worth of outcry and activism around water quality issues, as well as water affordability and accessibility issues. It's important that we keep those in mind as well. But, you know, we were not very aware of that at the time. And again, water wasn't necessarily, you know, making the headlines every day. So it wasn't the story of the moment yet. So, the first thing that I did in terms of community involvement upon moving here was I joined the Flint City Charter Review Advisory Committee, because Flint was in the process of reviewing and revising its city charter for the first time since the 1970s. And I thought that would be a way where I could take some of my political science background and bring it to bear upon a local issue of real significance. And so I came into that work thinking that maybe I might have some special skill or expertise that I could offer the community. And I very quickly found that that wasn't really the case. In fact, it was the local folks who knew way more about this stuff than I did. And not just the history of Flint in particular, but just the way that local government works. I mean, I came to realize just how impoverished my own education had been with respect to local government. And so I very quickly started to realize that I was in the back seat here, not the front seat in any way. I was just following the lead of my fellow residents and trying to listen to them and learn from them. And so that was kind of a real eye-opener to me, and it also helped to set the stage, I think, for some of the later work that I did on the water crisis.
One second. I have to stop you, because there's something that you said that I think it's very important, that, and we need to circle around that or sort of walk back to that particular point. And this is that the residents were aware of how local government functioned. They had already experienced the local government. I want you to talk about those experiences and what they shared, or what you had come to know about how local government functioned, because we don't know. We might guess, or we see some YouTube clips, but what's really going on? What are people dealing with?
Well, part of the irony in my case is that my mom is actually a city manager. She's the city manager for the city of Tacoma. And before that, she was the city attorney. And so I grew up being pretty aware of local government, although, you know, despite all of that, you know, I had never really learned the nuts and bolts, really, of how local government is administered. And what I've found is that the folks who are active within the community here, politically active here, I mean, they are very, very carefully attuned to that stuff in a way that I wasn't, even as the son of a city attorney and city manager, you know, growing up. You know, they go to the city council meetings, or these days they watch them on Zoom. You know, they follow local news really closely. They really care about the city charter and the form of government that the charter outlines. And, you know, there's a kind of pride that people take in the fact that Flint effectively has its own constitution and that whole tradition of home rule. Which, you know, in Michigan goes back over 100 years. But in Flint especially, I think there's a lot of importance that's placed upon local political autonomy. And one of the foundations of that is having your own local constitution and taking that seriously and making sure people stick to it. And so I was really impressed right off the bat with just how significant people thought that was and how much work this committee was putting into going through the charter carefully, you know, section by section, and really doing their research and looking at other cities too, and kind of trying to figure out what was best for our city, with a lot of sensitivity to local history and culture and so forth. So, but then on the activist side as well, once I started getting more involved in the activist scene here, that value, that importance placed upon local government, again, it kind of shone through everything people were talking about and everything they were doing. This idea that we kind of have the right and responsibility to govern ourselves. I mean, that's part of our political constitution. It's part of the pride that we take in being from Flint. You know, Flint is a city where when something needs to get done, people figure out how to do it. When a fight mm-hmm. needs to be fought, you know, people take it on. And so, I've seen kind of manifestations on that, both on sort of the more institutional side, people who are concerned with political institutions and how we kind of craft those and operationalize those. And then, you know, people on the activist side who are just very grassroots, but taking that same kind of attitude out into the streets.
I'm wondering how this transition or rather the tradition of home rule and the belief in political autonomy was upended by this emergency manager law. And in particular, how that shaped opportunities to engage local government that were typically there in Flint.
Sure. Well, yeah, the emergency manager law is, of course, in direct contradiction to this whole tradition of home rule that mm-hmm. Has been part of the Michigan Constitution for over 100 years. Home rule is premised on the idea that, municipalities have the ability to determine for themselves what their kind of political lives are going to look like, what form of government they're going to have, as well as a variety of other, you know, decisions that need to be made. And so the emergency manager law is really premised on the idea that at least sometimes in some places when government gets into the hands of some people, and we can talk about what kind of people they might have in mind in a moment here, but that effectively it gets mismanaged. And to the point where the city becomes unable to sustain itself. It becomes unable to do what cities are supposed to do. It becomes unable to provide basic services like police and fire and roads and streetlights. And it becomes unable to pay back all of the bondholders who have loaned it money over mm-hmm. the years. That's an important consideration here. And so in those situations, when you have a local government that's being mismanaged, that has dug itself into a financial hole, that is spending more money than it is taking in, and when there doesn't seem to be the political will to make the hard choices that need to be made to get out of that hole, then sometimes the state has to step in and mm-hmm. appoint somebody of its own choosing who, you know, supposedly knows better when it comes to financial matters, but is also disconnected from local politics and doesn't have to worry about getting elected and so forth. And so can just make decisions, you know, that are the right ones, quote unquote, from a financial perspective, regardless of whether they're popular or not. That's the whole theory. Although, of course, in practice, you know, when you look at the way the law actually gets applied, of course, it's getting applied, disproportionately, not just to poor cities, but also to predominantly African American cities.
That's right.
What happens when emergency managers come in is that they completely sideline, you know, local elected officials. And so, you know, you have these communities full of people who, take their right to vote, their right to govern themselves all the more seriously because they know what it's like, you know, not to have that right, or for that right really not to have any real, you know, teeth to it. I'm living in a community here in Flint where, you know, we've got people around who still remember very well, you know, the civil rights era from, you know, their own personal involvement.
That's right.
We know people who fought and suffered and died in some cases to you know, to have the right to govern themselves. And so when you have, in the case of the last administration, especially, an overwhelmingly, white administration, led by a white governor coming into black cities and totally marginalizing local elected officials, predominantly or largely people of color, stripping them of their power and saying to the residents of those communities, we're going to decide what's best for you. Well, that just brings back all kinds of, memories of the bad old days. And so, I think that the fight for local autonomy here, goes back a long ways in the history of the city, but certainly Absolutely. Was reinvigorated by this very direct, frontal assault on the idea that the people of Flint should be able to manage their own affairs. I mean, one thing I think we do just need to, be real about here is that these cities like Flint do have some really serious challenges. I mean, there's no getting around that, and they can't do everything for themselves. I mean, the resources just aren't there a lot of the time. So, we definitely need to acknowledge that. And we also need to acknowledge that, sometimes city government isn't run as well as it could be. I mean, living here in the city, I've seen many examples of that. And I don't know if you've tuned into a Flint City Council meeting lately, but the city council, unfortunately, has become famous for just being totally unproductive, frankly. And so,
Ben, I transcribed 10 years of city council meetings for this.
Okay, wow. Well, I don't envy you. I think that we do need to be honest about that. But we also need to understand that when we talk about the kinds of challenges that a city like Flint is facing, they're not just challenges of management, right? So the whole ideology of emergency management is that the problem is you've got, bad managers at the local level, and you need to put better managers in place who have the requisite expertise, to make the decisions that mm-hmm. need to be made. But the fundamentally the challenges that Flint is dealing with, it's not that we've got the wrong people in power. It's that we've got some really serious structural, obstacles we've got to overcome in order to do anything. And it's important to understand that the state helps to determine what kinds of structural obstacles that a city like Flint is facing. They're not just like self-imposed, right? In fact, it's long histories of systemic racism and disinvestment and depopulation and deindustrialization and so forth. All of that provides the backdrop. Mm-hmm. But then within that, the state also is making its own decisions about how to divvy up its own revenue. And one of the things that happened in the lead up to Flint being taken over by the state is that the state withheld $55 million worth of revenue sharing that Flint otherwise would have gotten. And that's not a small amount of money for a city like Flint. So in other words, you have the state, making decisions about who's going to get what. And when it decides that Flint is not going to get money that it's historically been entitled to, then mm-hmm. that creates some major structural pressures. You also have state laws on the books that affect how much a city like Flint can tax its residents that are very constraining. And when you look at Michigan relative to other states, it is it's close to the top of the list in terms of just how constraining its state laws are around the ways in which local governments can generate revenue in the first place. And so, and of course, there are other things we could mention as well. But the other thing to say is that, when a city finds itself in financial trouble, it's not like you only have two options, right? Either you have the city just trying to do everything for itself on one hand, or you have an outright hostile takeover, right, by a state administration. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of in between. Even our current version of the emergency manager law, Public Act 436, it actually creates four options for cities when they end up in these kinds of situations. So you don't have to go straight to emergency management where you just sideline local elected representatives.
What are the other options?
So one thing that you could do is you could have a consent agreement of some kind between the state and the city that would empower local officials to do things that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do. So, for example, you know, one of the reasons why Flint got into trouble was that the city had really locked horns with local unions. And, you know, the unions really weren't budging much. And maybe that was the right position for them to take, by the way. I'm not saying it was wrong when, there were some new contracts being negotiated. But under, you know, what an emergency manager can do when they come to town is they can just shred those union contracts and start all over from scratch and say, or you're going to get what I say you're going to get.
That's correct.
A consent agreement could have empowered local elected representatives to exercise more strength in those kinds of negotiations and try to negotiate something that was more in the city's interest under the circumstances. So the bigger point here is that the state has the ability to empower folks who at least have some, democratic credibility because, they've been elected by residents to do what they're doing. And in the case of Flint, it decided not to do that. It decided that it didn't want these local folks to be wielding that kind of power. Instead, it would rather, bottle it up in one governor appointed person who is then going to make decisions, unilaterally. It doesn't have to work that way. There have been a lot of other proposals that have been made as to how the law might be reformed in order to incorporate more local involvement in governance. So instead of having just one person, you could have a board that maybe included a state appointee or two, but that also included local elected representatives, and maybe they would work together, right, to get a city out of a crisis.
Wow.
And it seems like not only would that look better from a democratic perspective, but there's obviously also just some benefit, you would think, to having more voices as part of these kinds of conversations.
Absolutely.
The problem, of course, when you hand power over to one person is that you encourage them to think that they have all of the competence they need to make these big, important decisions that they're making on behalf of everybody else. And they don't necessarily have to consult the real experts when they're pulling the trigger on something. And so that's a really dangerous situation to put a community.
Oh, yeah. You tie the community's hands behind its back and you push it up against a wall. And then you send one person in and say, okay, everyone else is sidelined. I'm the head person in charge. That's a recipe for disaster, especially considering a place like Flint, its history, and given the fact that a lot of the problems that the community face are shaped by multi-systemic issues that aren't very easily solved by one individual with one perspective.
Exactly. Yeah. There's just no way that you're going to be able to solve any complex issue without a really robust and diverse group of people being part of the conversation and having some real power to shape the kinds of decisions that are made. And so when you say it's a recipe for disaster, I think the Flint water crisis was the disaster that kind of proved
absolutely
that point for people. I think that up until that point, the last administration was ready to declare the law a success because they had, taken over a number of cities and school districts with this law. But, not too long after the news broke about Flint, there weren't any cities or school districts left that, under state receivership. Again, the state's narrative around that was that that's because the law worked. We got in there, we got the right people in there. And they made the tough choices. And yeah, it was a little bit painful, but it needed to be done. And now these cities and districts are back on their feet. And hopefully, they'll be able to sustain themselves moving forward. But then the Flint water crisis came along and it totally disrupted that narrative. And you had the governor having to admit to Congress when he went to DC to testify that the law had failed in Flint's case. And I'm not sure that what he took from that was that the law in general was a bad law, but Flint certainly dramatized the worst that could happen when
Absolutely.
You take this kind of approach to local governance.
Let's talk specifically how, you know, that moment where we have an emergency manager in place, how that shaped the sort of fielding of complaints from residents.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's important to understand that just, you know, on a structural level, like when residents started to develop concerns about water quality and water affordability for that matter, I mean, they didn't have elected representatives they could turn to with those concerns. What they had was one person with all the power who, yes, he had delegated some power to Dane Walling, the elected mayor. Dane was put in charge of the Public Works Department, for example. He was put in charge of sort of overseeing that or being the ultimate authority. And so, you know, there were local leaders who also, you know, were accused of residents of not listening and, you know, people who they thought should have taken more decisive action, but didn't. But, you know, at the end of the day, the emergency manager was always hovering in the background as the person who was always going to have the last word, especially anytime a particular course of action was going to be costly. And so, you know, a lot of people, you know, like to say that the switch to the river was made in the first place as a cost-saving measure, which I've always thought was way too simplistic. I think there was actually a lot that went into that decision that wasn't just about trying to save money. But certainly, once the city was on the river, one major hurdle to getting off of it was this idea that it was going to cost a lot of money to do it, and that money just wasn't there. And and so that was the mentality that was kind of in place at what was in, you know, effectively the highest level in the city. And but then you also had people in power who, again, it's like their job was not to listen to residents. I mean, it was precisely to do unpopular things. That's the whole point of emergency management, is that you put people in power who will do things that residents find to be unpopular. But it's just listening to residents, taking them seriously, acting on their concerns, putting their wishes first. That's just not in the job description of an emergency manager.
So I get that. And so if that person wasn't in place to sort of kiss residents' butts and make them feel good, right? There's something that you mentioned to me that sort of sticks out. See, it makes sense that they're not trying to please everybody and they're just trying to get the city back in black. Right. But if changing the water source wasn't about saving money, what was it all about?
Well, I mean, it depends on what we mean when we say it was about saving money. And it requires us to kind of put the switch into a bigger context. Certainly there was a feeling going back many years in Flint that Flint was paying too much for its water. And that had to, the underlying argument was that Flint was kind of disadvantaged by being on the Detroit water system. You know, we are at the northwesternmost extreme corner of the Detroit water system, which extends all through southeastern Michigan. And there's a cost that you pay for being that far out, right? You're going to be inherently, you're just going to pay more for water because it costs more to get it to you all the way out there. Mm-hmm. And going back many decades, you know, there was this idea that maybe Flint could have its own pipeline going to Lake Huron, either up through Saginaw Bay or due east, basically parallel to the pipeline that was owned and operated by Detroit. And so out of that idea, the developed Carignan-Dee water pipeline project overseen by the Carignan-Dee Water Authority, or KWA. And so Flint was involved from pretty early on in discussions for building this new pipeline under the aegis of the KWA. And yes, that was about cost savings, in the sense that the claim was that in the long run, it was going to bring people's water rates down. But it was also about control. It was also about this idea that Detroit has too much power over our water, and that Flint kind of has a right to manage its own water. And it ought to be the one, you know, determining how rates are set and how water is treated and distributed and so forth. So, that at least officially was part of the rationale for this new pipeline project. And, you know, it would take a long time to get into all of the weeds with it, but suffice to say, once it was officially announced that Flint was going to be part of that pipeline, Detroit was very upset by that and threatened to cut the city off totally, even before the pipeline was built. And there's some debate over just how serious it was when it made that threat, if that really was going to happen.
Especially when they came back to the table, said, "No, here, you know, we were playing."
They did. Yeah. I mean, I've spoken with people locally, like, for example, the president of the city council at the time, who was, he was pretty convinced that they were getting ready to double down on that threat. But, you know, again, there were different perceptions on both sides here. Bottom line is that, you know, Detroit certainly wasn't happy to lose Flint as a customer. And so it wasn't just a struggle over money. It was also about who was going to control water. Right. And what Flint's relationship with Detroit was going to be. And so, you know, the switch to the river really emerged out of all of that context. So were financial considerations part of that picture? Yeah, absolutely. But there was also a pretty significant power struggle going on. And yep. I think it's that power element that people lose sight of sometimes, because, you know, even though the activists that I'm working with here, I mean, they ended up advocating for sticking with Detroit. I mean, they're really big on solidarity with Detroit and, you know, these cities need to stick together and all of that. But I mean, I think that you could also make an argument really that Flint should have a little bit more autonomy when it comes to governing its own water. And that's part of the price you pay for that relationship with Detroit, is that you lose some autonomy.
It's almost like there's this tug of war that ensued. And then all of a sudden, decisions are made. And these decisions, in the end, the people who are impacted by the decisions are the residents. And, you know, I want you to talk about that piece, because, that stuff happened. And I agree. I really don't think that it was only about saving money. I love what you had to say. I want you to talk about how this power struggle impacted Flint residents.
Yeah.
And then how you became involved in this fight to turn things around and for people to begin to take them seriously in this space.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, maybe just to use the whole KWA project as a jumping off point for that. I mean, one of the reasons why people developed a lot of skepticism of the KWA project is that that was something that really didn't receive a whole lot of popular input, from what I can tell. There wasn't a whole lot of awareness even of what that was all about. I mean, even during the water crisis, after people started thinking and talking about water, you know, in a big way, you know, there are a lot of folks who didn't know anything about that whole history of the KWA. One of the things the activists tried to do was to get it put to a vote as to whether or not Flint was going to participate in that project. And it was something that really frustrated the drain commissioner, Jeff Wright, at the time. And
he was frustrated, Jeff.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the idea that decisions are being made about our water without our input that are going to have major ramifications for us in terms of both the cost and maybe also the quality of our water. I mean, that feeling, I think, was already alive and well, you know, before the, you know, quote unquote crisis really broke out in Flint.
Exactly. So
I think people knew that it was going to be an uphill battle getting listened to, you know, ensuring that residents on the receiving end of the water system were going to have some legitimate say about, you know, what kind of water they were drinking. And so I think that, you know, one of the stories that I tell in my book is that, as I see it, the water activism that developed in 2014 and early 2015, it really represented the fusion of a couple of different streams of people, right? On one hand, you had people like Claire McClinton and Naira Sharif and Bishop Bernadelle Jefferson, who had already been fighting against emergency management, who had kind of a history of organizing and political activism, who kind of had a whole political analysis already of what was going on in Flint and kind of understood the power structure that they were up against. But then on the other hand, you had this influx of people who, you know, did not have that kind of background, who were just drinking bad water or showering in water that was giving them rashes, or, you know, had seen their water change color and were, you know, worried about it. And so, you know, a lot of those folks were the ones who were initially raising the water quality issue and bringing that into public meetings. And the activists that had been working around water up to that point had been focused more on issues of affordability and accessibility, the way that folks were in Detroit. In Detroit, you know, in 2014, there was a huge wave of water shutoffs. There was national and international attention brought to the water shutoff issue. And you know, some of our Flint activists were involved in that stuff. So they, you know, there was stuff going on already in Flint around water affordability and accessibility. And the folks who were the seasoned activists, you know, were really the ones who were taking those issues on. Well, now you got this whole crop of new folks, people like, you know, Leon Walters and Melissa Mays and, you know, Tony Palladino and Florlissa Fowler. And those were the folks who were really starting to shift people's attention towards issues of water quality. Not that people weren't concerned about that already. They were, going all the way back to the early days after the switch. And even before the switch, people were concerned. They didn't want to drink Flint River water. They were skeptical of Flint River water. There's no doubt about that. But there was this kind of tipping point that I would place right around the, you know, January 2015, when the conversation on the activist side started to tip from water affordability and accessibility into water quality. And that really became the main emphasis.
Wasn't it because the city sent out a notice saying that there's something wrong with your water?
That had a lot to do with it. In January 2015, everybody got a letter from the city that informed them that the city was in violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act because of levels of trihalomethanes that, you know, were high. And that wasn't the first time people had been concerned, you know, that there'd been some official admission that there were issues with water quality. You know, there were boil water advisories in the late summer of 2014. GM had also switched its engine plant off of the river water because it was seeing a lot of corrosion of its parts. And so people were definitely already concerned, but the city had not yet admitted that there was a system-wide problem with water quality. It was really that letter of January 2015 that was the first official admission. And so, you know, that gave people something to latch onto. And it kind of put the city in a position where it had to account for itself. It had to start holding public meetings. It had to make a show of addressing the issue. That's when Veolia was brought in as a consultant to look at the water treatment process and water treatment plant and make recommendations. So, but it also really helped to spur, again, a whole new wave of water activism in Flint that was focused on water quality. And because, you know, what people were going to these meetings and realizing that folks on the official side either couldn't help them because they had no power, or you know, weren't interested in helping them or having even a serious conversation with them. You know, I think that was a major impetus for kind of taking the fight into the streets and trying to find other ways of bringing attention to what was going on with water quality and then agitating around that issue.
I think I really love what you're saying here, because very often in my conversations with Flint residents, I'm hearing that, you know, there's been a conflating of the water quality issues with other issues occurring within, you know, the city of Flint. Mm-hmm. Almost like to some degree, people are saying that people are allowing the water issues to represent everything that's wrong about the city of Flint. Right. And so it almost to the point of putting too much on it. Right. But I wonder, what what other avenue would they have? Because people almost, you know, even when we write a book, you have to have a hook.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And to me, what it brings me back to is the way that we define the Flint water crisis.
You know, come on now.
I think that, you know, we've part of the whole struggle around the Flint water crisis has been, well, A, just getting people to acknowledge that there was any kind of a crisis going on in the first place. That was phase one, right? But
yeah.
Part of that is a struggle over how we define the crisis, right? And what all it's taken to consist of and what its implications are. And, you know, part of the battle has been between people who are inclined to frame the crisis very narrowly as a matter of lead and water in particular. I mean, the Flint water crisis is known to people around the country and the world as a lead and water crisis. It's been a source of great frustration here because, of course, it didn't begin as a lead and water crisis. You know, lead
That's right.
showed up.
About that bacteria.
it began with concerns about bacteria and trihalomethanes and all manner of other things.
Exactly.
And, but, you know, defining it as a lead and water crisis does a couple of things. First, it makes it sound a lot more kind of solvable than it actually is, because even though lead and water is a tricky issue in many ways, and we're way behind as a country in dealing with that issue adequately, and you know, we're just now starting to see some really big, serious strides taken towards getting all of our lead pipes out of the ground. Relative to other kinds of water contaminants, lead is actually, you know, fairly easy to deal with. It might be expensive to deal with, but we know where the lead is coming from. We
That's
know
right.
how to get rid of it. You can sample pretty reliably for lead when you're determined to do it the right way. Anyways, there are other kinds of water quality issues that are much trickier to get under control, particularly issues of bacterial contamination. Also, trihalomethanes has been an issue plaguing the water utility industry for decades.
Absolutely. We want to hide the bacteria as opposed to change how we fundamentally run these systems.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in many European systems, for example, you don't chlorinate because you actually just build nice new shiny pipes and you don't need to worry about bacteria getting into the pipes. Here we have rickety water infrastructures that are full of holes. And so, you know, you're constantly getting contamination in there.
Thank you.
That you're trying to nuke with chlorine.
That
produces a whole host of side effects that have their own public health consequences. So even if we're just looking at the crisis as a water quality issue, we've got to look way beyond lead. And you know, the other effect of turning it into a lead and water crisis, just in terms of framing, is that you empowered a certain set of people for whom lead kind of became their thing or already was their thing, you know, their area of expertise. And then they became the ultimate authorities on all things water quality and on all things water crisis in Flint. And that had some pretty problematic, downsides associated with it, especially as certain relationships between those individuals and the community grew tenser and tenser. So, which we could talk about more if there's interest, but
wait, hold up. There's interest,
but
because we, you know, we need to hear about, you know, what had happened. Because I do know that there was a rush to conclude the crisis, the quote unquote crisis. Right. And I think, or at least I believe that, some of the concerns, or the beef was about how people were being used in that project, right? The project to conclude.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So I think, you know, the way that I see it is that, you know, getting officials to take the water crisis seriously in the first place, it really required a lot of hooting and hollering, you know, to make that happen. And people, you know, really, I don't want to say playing up the harm, but really trying to, like, put whatever harm they were experiencing through a megaphone, you know, just in order to get people to finally, you know, pay attention to them and take them seriously. Mm-hmm. And they were incredibly successful in doing that. And one of the reasons is that people were able to back their concerns up with some concrete scientific data that was showed that there was a, you know, systemic lead and water crisis. And once they had that smoking gun, then officials were on the hook. I mean, I still think to this day that a lot of folks on the official side never really believed they were dealing with like a true public health crisis in Flint. I think they thought they were dealing with a public relations crisis. But, you know, like it or not, they were on the hook. They at least had to make a show of, you know, taking action.
I love that you keep saying that. You keep saying, you refer to this as a show of addressing the issue. I love it.
I don't want to deny the fact that part of that show was that you had hundreds of millions of dollars coming to Flint.
Yeah.
You had a lot of people here on the ground who are doing some good work. And, so in calling it a show, I don't want to minimize any of that.
Absolutely.
But the fact of the matter is, for whatever reason, Flint blew up into a national story. I mean, there are other cities where you're having issues that potentially could, under other circumstances, become their own national story and embarrass the crap out of their state administration and you know, put those folks on the hook too. And sometimes that happens. How exactly it happens, why it happens, where it does, at what time, I don't know that I can really fully explain that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, in Flint, it became a big story. There was real harm being done. You know, people were on the hook. Just how much harm, though, was very much a subject of debate from the beginning, and it remains a subject of debate right up to the present day. But
interesting.
But suffice to say, at the very least, there was this kind of mobilization around the crisis. But it's important to understand that a lot of people who were leading that mobilization, I think, did see it as a relatively solvable problem, defined the way they were defining it, right? We got to bring the lead levels down system-wide. Well, that did start to happen in 2016. And by the time we got to 2017, the lead data was looking pretty good. And so you had an attempt being made on that official side to kind of bring people together around a consensus that the crisis was effectively over and that people could move on. And so, they were operating on a timeline that was very different from the community's timeline, for starters. I mean,
for sure.
People were not by early 2017 ready to accept that we knew enough to say the crisis was over, that we'd looked into all of the issues that needed to be looked into. So I was involved with a team that did some sampling for Legionella bacterial contamination in the summer of 2016. But without getting into all of the backstory there, I mean, there are all kinds of delays that cropped up around that work. We weren't able to start sampling until the weather started getting cooler again. And so, you know, at the end of 2016, we were presenting some data on all of that to the community, but we had to preface it by saying we didn't, you know, collect these samples when we should have been collecting them, right? When there was most likely to be a problem. And so, what we were communicating about water quality was kind of provisional in that sense. Mm-hmm. The numbers we're getting don't look horrible, but we also need to be careful about reading too much into them. And we need to keep looking into people's concerns and doing more research. That was kind of the position that we were taking around this issue of Legionella in particular. But, you know, as we were coming out with that messaging, there were these folks on the other side who were at a point where they saw any kind of complicating of that official narrative that things were getting so much better and the crisis is basically over. They saw anything that complicated that as fear-mongering. Mm-hmm. And, they tried to shut it down. And things got really, really ugly. I mean, particularly with Professor Mark Edwards, who, you know, at one point was held up as kind of like this hero figure.
Yes.
For the work that he did with residents and so forth. But I mean, he ended up attacking other scientists, my colleagues. He ended up attacking residents. He sued activists for millions of dollars. He threatened actually to sue MIT Press to scare them into not publishing my book.
Oh, boy.
And actually, that's just the tip of the iceberg. It goes on and on and on. So, but at the end of the day, what it came down to was that he, along with the state, along with at least some folks at the EPA, were more or less ready to move on from Flint, right, by the end of 2016. And the way that they were going to do that was by putting this you know, really kind of firm scientific consensus out there that, you know, the water had recovered. And from that point on, anybody who continued to raise questions and concerns and so forth, you know, it kind of made them look like either they were fear-mongering or they had an ulterior motive. Absolutely. Or that they just didn't understand or that they were backwards or something like mm-hmm. that.
What's in it for them?
Right, right. And so that's the way, unfortunately, that our activists started to get characterized as being quote-unquote tribal. I mean, and that's a quote. I mean, this is the language that started being used to describe Flint residents, that they just were not coming around to the science, to the obvious, you know, truth that the water in Flint was better. And so you literally had white men from outside our community writing in print that Flint residents were tribal and they were anti-science. And you know, but even more like sympathetic versions of this, what they'll do is they'll characterize residents as being just so traumatized that they're incapable of trusting anybody ever again. And but that's its own kind of victim blaming, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because it's like, what's wrong with you? You know, we did everything you could expect us to do to kind of fix the situation.
And now nothing's
for
good enough.
And nothing's good enough now, and you're ungrateful, and you just don't understand. And so, you know, I think that is a hugely problematic narrative for all kinds of reasons. I mean, aside from the fact that it often has this very kind of racist tinge to it,
yes. You know, but, because we love to tell people to, you know, that they need to take personal responsibility and don't be so whipped, you know, by your reality.
Don't be a victim. Yeah. Right. And so, yeah, Flint residents have been, they've been, you know, wrapped up in these narratives into this whole idea that, you know, we've got this culture of victimhood in this country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so people are just going to keep pretending like they're hurt effectively because they're going to get something out of that. I mean, it's offensive on so many levels, but among the levels is that, you know, the underlying implication is that on the official side, again, our response to the Flint water crisis was like a model response.
Exactly.
Right? Y'all got more money than you could ever have hoped for. Y'all got more attention than you could ever have hoped for. You had incredible people on the ground doing incredible work, you know, working their hands to the bone for no reward, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is the narrative. And so anybody who has any kind of, you know, gripe at this point, you know, there's something wrong with them. Right. And the fact of the matter is, you know, from the beginning, even though it was in many respects a pretty large scale and impressive response,
absolutely,
there were problems all the way through in terms of the way in which the community was being engaged, in terms of the extent to which people had a seat at the table and a real say over what was happening, mm-hmm. in terms of whether people's concerns were being adequately respected and looked into, in terms of how the science was being communicated to people. You know, there's no, when, you know, I was in the middle, I guess, of that slice of the community that had major concerns about how the crisis response was being handled. And, you know, was every concern a totally defensible concern? I don't know. I mean, you could look at them one by one, but certainly there were lots of very legitimate concerns, I think, that people had. And from their perspective, the fight wasn't over when we switched over to the river and started putting corrosion control.
That's right.
Treatment, mm-hmm. water treatment plant. That was the beginning of the fight. I mean, that was just phase one of the fight. And really the vast majority of the quote unquote fighting people have done around water in Flint has been from that point on. And it's going on right up to the present day.
That's correct. I mean,
so we still have lead and galvanized service lines in the ground that you know, haven't been taken.
That's
out.
Correct.
We still haven't had one single person go to trial.
Preach.
For, you know, committing a crime. We have a settlement proposal now on the table coming out of these class action suits that a lot of people are dissatisfied with, and frankly, a lot of people are going to fall through the cracks or get peanuts out of
this. Let's talk about that. What's your take on this settlement? It doesn't sound like, you said it's peanuts. So what's your take, and then what do you think is actually necessary, particularly considering the role of well, the fact that there hasn't been a great deal of transparency and truth.
Well, I mean, so I think the one of the core lessons here is that, you know, class action lawsuits are not very attractive vehicles for social justice. I mean, they have a lot of limitations. And one of the things that makes them so problematic is that they get people's hopes up so high. Mm-hmm. And I was seeing this from the very beginning back in 2016. I remember going to a big meeting at the Dort Federal Credit Union Center here, which is where they play hockey and stuff. But in this case, they had these class action attorneys up on the stage speaking to, you know, bleachers full of Flint residents mm-hmm. about these suits that were just being announced. And, you know, I was just looking around the room at folks who, you know, some of whom were just clearly having a really hard time. And thinking that, man, they are getting their hopes up so high right now that this could be the answer to some of their problems. And it's just not going to be the answer. I mean, it just isn't. And I mean, at that time, especially, I was really skeptical that people were going to get anything at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And so I personally kept my distance from the class action stuff. I did not sign up with any attorneys. And this isn't to knock anybody who did do that, because we had a lot of residents do it, again, hoping that something would come of it at the end of the day. But, you know, what I was seeing was these attorneys flooding into the community from the outside, like a lot of people flooded in from the outside, mm-hmm. from all different walks of life, who obviously stood to gain, you know, from the work that they were doing here. And I think we're off, you know, making a lot of promises, or at least, you know, again, stimulating a lot of hope without necessarily being able to back it up.
That's right.
And so that to me just seemed like a whole nother exploitative situation.
I was actually aware of attorneys coming in, people filling out paperwork, but then they call the office line is disconnected. They go to the office, it's closed. I've spoken with people who have started over and over and over again in this process. It's maddening.
I mean, we have had, at one point I had the numbers at my fingertips and now I'm going to have trouble remembering them. But I mean, we've had, I don't know, upwards of 50 like lawyers and law firms, you know, running around signing people up. Anybody can sign people up. So you have some residents who sign up with multiple people. And then we ended up having a fight amongst the attorneys over who was representing whom. Mm-hmm. and they had to create this massive like chart just to try to figure out whose clients were whose. So, you know, that became a complete mess. But then you have people like forget who they've signed up with because this has been dragging on for so many years. Or again, maybe they've talked to multiple lawyers or sets of lawyers and now they're confused. And I mean, I myself was having trouble. At one point, I went to my mom, who's an attorney, and said, I can't make sense of all this legal stuff. I mean, there's just so much going on. Please, will you help me? And wow. I mean, and that's somebody with a PhD in political science, who's just completely lost and befuddled. And so you can imagine how disempowering it is for the average resident. Not to say that I'm, again, any smarter than the average resident, but the point is that you can't expect people to keep up with all this stuff or even to keep track of how they themselves fit into it all. And so, you know, ultimately the work that actually gets done on cases like these, it's not getting done in, you know, partnership with residents or anything like that. These are lawyers arguing amongst themselves behind the closed doors about what Flint residents deserve, mm-hmm. right? About what a just outcome is in this case. And for the most part, we have no clue what's going on. So, I actually just happened to get subpoenaed by Veolia a few weeks ago. Veolia is, you know, one of the maybe the largest water engineering firm in the world. And they are coming for everything that I have on Flint. I mean, all the way down to demanding that I collect comments that I've made on other people's social media posts about the water crisis.
Oh my goodness.
For the past 5 years.
Oh my goodness. Keep going. I'm sorry.
I'm supposed to put all of that together and organize it and hand it to them on a silver platter so they can do whatever they like with
wow.
it.
Wow.
It's and this is after they've already deposed over 180 people in fighting these cases that have been brought against them. And so the, you know, how exactly after all that time it is they need access to 5 years of my files and my social media posts and so forth.
That's interesting.
I don't know. It's bizarre, but part of what I'm trying to convey here is that I have no idea what they're up to. I mean, I have some guesses about what they're up to, but I don't know what's been going on with them. I mean, even the stuff that's come out of these suits that's public, I mean, it would take you forever to go through all of it.
Absolutely.
And to try to figure out what all that history is and what all the dynamics are and the interests that are involved. And it is completely overwhelming. And so, you know, this puts people, I mean, even if they're not getting subpoenaed, mm-hmm. into a very vulnerable and disempowered, you know, position in all of this. So, you know, I actually was stunned when we heard that the state was going to put up $600 million. I mean, that was actually way more than I ever thought was going to be put into the pot. But even with that, I mean, it sounds like an impressive figure. But then you got to look at how it's actually going to be sliced up.
That's right.
And that's where you start to realize just how possible it is to have a big, impressive number and then but then to have the majority of residents feel like they're being disrespected. Because especially if you are an adult in Flint, you are not automatically part of this. This settlement, you're not automatically going to get anything out of this. You at the very least need to own property. That'll get you something, but it's not going to get you more than $1,000. Beyond that, you have to prove that you've been harmed by the water.
That's interesting.
And that's something that almost nobody can do.
That's
I mean, you have to have like a doctor's note, not only saying you are suffering this health symptom, but it's because of the water. I mean, you could probably guess what percentage of Flint residents have notes like that. I mean,
oh,
it's very, very
difficult. I'm so struck by all of this, I have to tell you, because a lot of the information that people would need to prove their claims is held by the state. So the state says,
well,
prove
yep.
that
yeah.
we poison you, knowing yeah. knowing that it has the proof. And it's been receiving the proof over time. And then it says, okay, you prove it. And if you can't, oh, well, too bad for you.
Well, and it has a history of trying to cover things up, especially with the pneumonia and Legionnaire's disease issue. But so one thing I will say is that with blood lead, the attorneys do have access to the state's records about who had elevated levels of blood lead, as at least if they manage to get tested, right? And that's a big caveat too,
exactly.
Because like in my case, I was told that my son was 3 years old when all of this was going down initially, and he'd you know been exposed to the water, and we were told by our family doctor at first that we didn't need to get him tested, And it wasn't until a couple months later that we finally decided, you know, let's go ahead and do this. But by that time, you know, he hadn't been drinking the water for a couple of months. So the result that we got was basically meaningless in terms of his past exposure. It gave us a baseline to work with moving forward. But a lot of other people ended up in that situation. So even if you do have a blood lead test on the books with the Department of Health and Human Services, you know, that will be factored in to the settlement, but it doesn't necessarily capture
the whole picture.
Might have been done.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's a big issue for people. But then beyond that, I don't know if you've followed this whole story about the bone lead scans.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So this is another, kind of incredible development where you have people who missed out on reliable blood lead tests like me, who have another option, at least in theory, to measure just how much lead their kids have been exposed to by looking at lead that's stored in the bones.
Mm-hmm.
And I myself was planning on taking my son in for a bone lead scan. I was literally looking at times and getting ready to sign up when I got an email from, or it was right around that time. I don't want to over dramatize it here, but I got an email from Dr. Lawrence Reynolds, who used to run the Mott Children's Health Center here. He's a retired pediatrician, an environmental justice leader within the community. He's now the mayor's chief medical advisor, or only medical advisor.
Okay. And
he had sent an email around to us, a number of us, saying, look out, this bone lead scanning technology that they're using hasn't been certified for use on human beings. Oh no. He said, this is the Tuskegee, you know, experiment all over again, or you know, some version of that. And he ended up writing, a really powerful letter to the judge, Judge Levy, who's overseeing the settlement, raising this concern among other concerns. But so now all of a sudden, you know, you had thousands of residents who'd signed up their kids for bone lead scans who are wondering whether they're actually going to, you know, harm their kids even more. So that's been a complete mess. I mean, and wow. Even if they had figured that out and gotten the right kind of technology available to the community, there wouldn't have been nearly enough time to get the kids in for these scans, you know, before people had to decide whether to opt in to the settlement. So that's, and then the other option is that you go get your kid psychologically evaluated. And that's been a mess too. That's something that I also looked into as a parent.
It's what's interesting here though, is you're saying that, and I want the folks to be clear on this, the state had to, you know, there was a period of time where there was, it was basically the state's job to figure out what that evidence needed to look like. So essentially, did the state decide this would be the standard, this test that can't be performed on humans?
The state and the class action
attorneys,
wow. You know, they have been at the negotiating table for a long time. I mean, the state tried to get these cases thrown out 15 times. So that legal battle has been going on for years. You know, eventually they all ended up at the negotiating table, and they had to lay out not only how much money was going to be put into the pot, but, you know, what the criteria were going to be for how it was divvied up. And as I understand it, it was the state, you know, the state wasn't the only party that was being sued that was part of all of this. But this, I mean, the state's putting in $600 million. So they've got the lion's share of the say. And they were the ones, as I understand it, who basically crafted these different categories that people were going to fall into and what evidence was going to put you in one category over another.
Interesting.
And so, again, there's a lot that we don't know about everything that went on behind the scenes. So at some point, this researcher person, you know, entered the picture with this device, somebody who I think is at MIT, actually, you know, they were hoping could be, and, you know, maybe the intentions were totally pure here, but it, you know, it was another case where there was a particular kind of medical, you know, device that was experimental that was being offered to a vulnerable community at a time of, wow. of really its greatest vulnerability as far as these, you know, the lawsuits are concerned. And I think, but the, you know, it wasn't just the state, you know, the class action attorney folks, they went along with it. And in fact, there was one particular team of attorneys that, for whatever reason, developed a special relationship with this bone lead scan guy. And so at first, it was only their clients that were able to get appointments. And so the first fight was over just opening it up to other people as well, who'd signed up with other attorneys.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's initially what these other lawyers were working on. But then the news broke that the device itself was problematic. And then that just threw everything into disarray.
This is crazy. This is straight up crazy. Crazy talk, crazy talk.
Another crazy chapter in a crazy story.
Okay.
That's seemingly endless.
I'm struck by all of this, you know, at the same time, you know, as you know, I'm a Flintstone.
Yes.
We're not good with all of this craziness and people trying to play us. And so I'm really wondering, how are people pushing back right now? What's on the horizon on with that mission, with that movement?
Well, with the settlement, people have adopted a couple different strategies to kind of protest the terms of the settlement. Some folks have opted out and they are going to keep fighting, and they have a very steep hill to climb, frankly, if they are going to end up getting money out of the state that it hasn't already put up. But they've decided that that's what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. Now, they are in the minority. Most folks have decided to opt in, from what I can tell. We don't have the final number yet, but it seems that most folks who really made a conscious decision around this anyway decided to opt in. But some folks are opting in sort of with objections. The only way that you can file official objections with the judge is to opt in. If you opt out, then again, you're in a different category. So there are people who've opted in who've written up their concerns and sent them off to the judge. Now, whether that ends up changing the settlement that's on the table in any substantive way, we don't know. I mean, this is another part of the disempowering nature of this whole process, is that a lot depends on the individual judge that you've ended up with and what she, in this case, thinks is fair. Mm-hmm. And so we're just, you know, I think it's in June that residents are going to have an opportunity to
get in front of Judge Levy.
Get in front of Judge Levy and articulate these concerns aloud, and we'll see what comes of that. So that's on the settlement side. There are other cases that are like, so Veolia is an example of an entity that has decided not to settle and is going to keep fighting. And if it needs to, you know, apparently come after residents like me in order to advance its case, then that's what it's going to do. And so, mm-hmm. You know, that's going to keep going on for a while as well. But beyond that, you know, as far as the criminal charges are concerned, you know, there were people down in front of the courthouse protesting when those were announced, particularly because they were concerned that Governor Snyder wasn't charged with, serious enough crimes for his role in all of this. But as far as like what to do about that, I don't know that there's much people can do other than kind of get out into the street in that way. We're still just kind of waiting to see what happens with those. Of course, the initial strategy always is to get them thrown out of court. And so, you know, we're still seeing all of that stuff play out. Beyond that, as far as the pipes are concerned, some of us here are trying to mobilize around getting these last pipes out of the ground. And that's a big, long saga in and of itself, with lots of twists and turns and messy backstory. But suffice to say, there are a lot of residents that we've come across who, you know, are at risk of falling through the cracks during this process. And
who are these? Can you specify not the names, but the categories of folk?
Yeah. So one category is people who have officially opted out of the pipe replacement process, but they've done so maybe without all of the information that they might need to make a fully informed choice about that. They've maybe opted out because they've seen how messy the process has been. Like, I've heard people say, I don't want my yard dug up and then never repaired. I mean, that's actually what happened in my yard. I mean, I literally still have a muddy mess out there in between the sidewalk and the street because they never repaired my yard after they dug out my service line. That's actually a big consideration for a lot of people. So, you have people opting out, you know, for reasons kind of like that. And it may be the case that if the right community person or community group was to come to them and just help them to, I don't know, you know, think about the choice in a different way, that they might decide to opt in. So that's, you know, we're kind of on the lookout for folks who fall into that category. But there are other folks who, despite, you know, whatever attempts have been made to reach them, have not been reached and don't know that they need to proactively opt in. That was not the case initially, or at least for a long stretch of time when these replacements were being done. There wasn't so much emphasis on people opting in. But starting in 2019, the city really started to insist upon having an opt-in form from people before they started digging. And so that means that you've got to actually reach people. You've got to make sure they understand what's going on. You've got to help them follow up. And, you know, I've encountered situations even just in my own neighborhood where somebody was perfectly willing to opt in. They just needed a little help, extra help doing that. But there are folks who, whose doors have been knocked on multiple times, or they've just never opened the door, and they could have good reason for not opening the door, you know, especially if there's some kind of official looking person at that door.
Exactly.
So, we are trying to identify folks like that who, might be more receptive to community people working through social networks to try to reach them and explain to them what's going on and help them. But, it's also important to know that pipes are only being replaced at homes that are currently inhabited and that have an active water account.
Wouldn't that be problematic in a city like Flint with the vacancy rate as high as it is?
A couple of problems with that. First of all, some of these homes are occupied. They're just they don't have active water accounts. I just saw on Facebook the other day somebody posting that I just haven't had the money to get my water turned back on, so I can't opt in. So there are people like that who fall into that category. But then you've also got the issue of homes that are now vacant that could become inhabited again in the near future even, that are, not getting their pipes replaced during this whole process. And you could have people moving into those homes who have no clue about any of this history and don't know that they're drinking through a lead straw. And so, just because we get the pipes out of the ground at every inhabited home, it doesn't mean that we've gotten all the lead out of the ground in Flint. There's going to be lead left in our system. And so one of the things we're advocating for is for some kind of a backstop there for people who later on realize that they've got a lead service line who didn't know it before or who changed their minds. Maybe they opted out. Now they want to opt in. We want to make sure that everybody who is ever living in a home with a lead service line and wants that thing out of there has a way to get it taken
to get it done
for free. And so, we now have a state law on the books that requires municipalities, all municipalities, regardless of whether or not they've had a water crisis, to replace their lead service lines progressively over a period of years. So at the very least, we're hoping we can use that as a backstop. So when we identify instances where we have a resident with a lead service line who was missed the first time around, we can point to that law and say to the city, you have an obligation to get this thing out under state law. But, ideally, we'd be reaching as many people as possible right now while the money is on the table from the state and the feds to get these lines out. And so over the next couple of months, there's a kind of a little grassroots coalition that has developed around this, people working together on this issue. And so, we're going to be pushing for that.
Oh, Ben, I'm so struck by this. Why we got to force people to do what's right?
Well, the other thing to say about it is that the framework within which these replacements are taking place in the first place is that the city was sued by the National Resources Defense Council and some other entities at with residents like Melissa Mays and the Concerned Pastors for Social Action participating. And it was out of that settlement, that legal settlement, that we got the money for the pipe replacement, or at least for the bulk of it. And so, but the NRDC, which is a group I've been working with on this issue, they've consistently had to come back to the city and basically compel it using legal threats to live up to its role in that settlement.
To what it agreed to do.
Yeah. I mean, so for example, there's been a whole debate over whether or not the city is required to even dig at all in a couple of neighborhoods that are mostly newer neighborhoods. You have newer construction there. And the city's been saying, well, we're sure that it's copper under the ground there. Nobody's got lead in those neighborhoods. What the NRDC has been saying is, well, look, first of all, we've been surprised where lead pipes have popped up, sometimes. We don't know for sure that there's no lead there. And in fact, the model that we're using to predict where the lead lines are suggests that there very well might be some lead in those neighborhoods. So why wouldn't you get some eyes on the problem and determine, whether or not you need to be taking pipes out? And and you wouldn't believe how hard they've fought not to do that. So it's been multiple trips to the courtroom to just try to get them to dig at least a few holes, like to double check that these neighborhoods are in the clear. So that's the kind of stuff that's been going on. And it's not just that, it's other things too. But yeah, it's forcing people to do the right thing. That's the right way to put it.
So, and this will be our final question. How are folks fighting back? How are they fighting back to regain home rule?
Well, you know, one of the implications of the water crisis, as I see it, is that it really did result in the restoration of home rule in Flint, and it happened much more speedily than it would have otherwise. I mean, it's important to remember that even though the last emergency manager left in March of 2015, before there was an official Flint water crisis, we still had a city administrator with special powers who was in place right at the heart of city administration, who was effectively part of the emergency manager system, at least in a kind of, you know, de facto way. And she was one of the people who was making it harder to switch off of the Flint River when concerns started to arise. Mm-hmm. So after the crisis really blew up the way that it did, the mayor's powers were restored, and she was able to fire that city administrator mm-hmm. and put a new person in place. Eventually, the city council, within a matter of months, got its power back too. And that was all officially, you know, in the name of helping put Flint in a position to lead its own recovery. And so, you know, even there were also some other kinds of motivations there in the background, maybe. The water crisis helped bring democracy back to Flint in a weird way, mm-hmm. At least in the sense of getting rid of emergency management. And that emergency manager law is still sitting on the books untouched. But no new cities or districts have been taken over since the Flint water crisis happened. And so I think that there's been a very powerful lesson about democracy that's come out of all of this. And it has changed the political atmosphere here. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that Flint was empowered to do everything that needed to be done to take charge of the recovery. You know, so we have had a lot of money flow into the city, but there are major questions that people have about how that money has been spent and who's spending it and who's even aware of how those decisions are being made. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk to our water activists here, what they'll say is that, you know, yeah, we had all this money come in, but what do we have to show for it? You know, we do have almost all of our lead service lines out of the ground. I mean, that's something to be proud of, really. I mean, it should have happened years ago. We should be done with that by now. But, you know, that's just an example of how the money comes in, looks great. Eventually, in this case, the work is going to get mostly done. But, you know, it took years longer than it needed to. You had a lot of lack of transparency there, some real issues around community engagement. I mean, and so that's, those are the kinds of concerns that tend to arise around any and every example of money coming into the city, you know, for one thing or another. Mm-hmm. And so I think moving forward, you know, we really need to see that when Flint is getting resources to help address these kinds of issues, that the way they're being deployed is in a transparent and accountable and inclusive, participatory, democratic manner. Mm-hmm. And we're a long ways from having realized that here in Flint. I mean, the other thing to say is that when we talk about water management, I mean, Flint has its own water treatment plant. Obviously, it has its own Department of Public Works. That's not stuff that the city hires contractors to come in and do certain jobs and so forth, right? But that's still an important part of our public sphere here in Flint. And that's something that, again, we should not only have a good understanding of how it's working, but we should have some say over how it's working
that's
too.
Right.
We should have a say over how water gets managed here in Flint. And you would think that of all places in Flint, you know, we would have a water utility that now had some pretty robust relationships with people in the community and was committed to being more open and inclusive. And in fact, it's just the opposite. I mean, if anything, it's gotten worse since all of this happened. We have a Department of Public Works that does a poor job of communicating about the work that it's doing with residents. And I know that you know, as a resident, having my water shut off randomly without any kind of warning, and you know, water main breaks without boil water advisories, and just any number of other things that that really ought to be done better. And we are supposed to have a water system advisory council in place now here in Flint. It's now a matter of state law that we have such a body in place. Mm-hmm. It still doesn't exist. In 2021, we don't have, residents actively overseeing the way that our water is managed, even though it's a matter of state law. So mm-hmm. there are elements like this of what it means to be truly self-governing that really ought to be in place by now, but aren't. And so, we're advocating around that as well.
Wow. You fight to get the recognition, to get the laws, and now the fight continues to get them to do what they're supposed to do.
The community is still on a path towards healing and recovery. And, and it may be on that path to some extent forever. And that's one of the reasons why you can't just draw neat, tidy lines between crisis and post-crisis.
Exactly.
And, there are going to be people living in this community who carry this with them their whole lives. And so, the fight is really always ongoing from that perspective. It's always about doing the next thing that needs to be done. And, the people who've thrown themselves into it and are committed for the long haul, I mean, that's really what they're focused on. It's not so much on patting ourselves on the back and being all proud of how much we've accomplished. It's about, okay, what is the next thing that needs to be done? And there is plenty of work that still needs to be done in Flint.
Wow. Brother Ben, Pauly, thank you so much for joining me today. I learned a lot, not just about what Flint residents went through throughout this journey. I learned a lot about state governance, what options are in front of a state when it's contending with cities who are struggling. At the same time, I'm struck by what Flint's residents continue to contend with. And I'm just, hoping for the best moving forward. Thanks again for joining me today. I learned so much.
Thanks so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
Fantastic. To learn more about the crisis, be sure to pick up your copy of Tank to Tap, Flint's Journey from Crisis to Recovery on Amazon or your favorite digital bookshelf. Thanks for tuning in to the Tank to Tap podcast. Please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. Till next time, pivot forward.